Yes, sir.
Make sure they don't get too close. If McCoy spots them, we're dead. They'll vanish, and we may never pick them up again.
I'm on it, sir, and we're ready to roll when you are.
No, said Mariano. Let Rossetti handle it. Get me into that house. I want to see everything they've been doing, and get it all to Al-Hassani. They raced to Mount Ebal in the dark of night. By 11 local time, with the help of the navigator's GPS, they reached the outskirts of the Palestinian stronghold of Nablus, and in another 15 minutes they reached the base of Mount Ebal and realized anew what a long climb they had ahead. After hiding the SUV in a patch of brush, they gathered their equipment and began working their way up the north face. Natasha's maps put the summit at about 3,000 feet above sea level, but they weren't going to have to go quite that far. The two caves they had seen on the mountain's west side in the satellite imagery were located two-thirds of the way up and roughly 150 yards apart. For tonight, at least, these were the targets, and they quickly began their ascent. Mariano crept up the stairs of the Gozal house. He held a .45 in one hand, a flashlight in the other. He didn't expect trouble, but he hated surprises. Having already found the maps and the laptops and a dozen unwashed coffee mugs spread across the kitchen, he headed for the master bedroom and soon came across the medical supplies that had helped Aaron Bennett recover over the past few days. "Put one over there and another in the lamp," he said, directing two of his men as they planted microphones throughout the house. They had been listening to the Bennett's conversations for days, using laser microphones aimed at Miriam Gozal's windows, but they had been imperfect at best and hadn't worked at all when their subjects had been in the basement. Mariano's phone began vibrating. "Rossetti?" Mariano whispered into a headset.
"Yes, sir. We're about a mile and a half from the base."
"Do you have a visual?"
"Affirmative. The Barak girl is about halfway up. Mr. Bennett is close behind. Mrs. Bennett is a ways back. She's struggling quite a bit."
"I bet she is," thought Mariano, still surprised that Aaron hadn't died from hypothermia under the DMZ. "Stay on them," he said, "and stay out of sight." He was going in alone. Bennett double-checked his harness and helmet. He took another few minutes to check over the rest of his equipment as well, and to make sure Aaron and Natasha were ready. Then he turned on his headlamp and eased toward the edge of the cave. Bennett could tell his wife wasn't enthusiastic about his doing this without her, but there was no other way. Aaron had barely recovered, and Bennett didn't feel right about sending Natasha in by herself, no matter how experienced she was. "All set?" he asked as he donned gloves and took hold of the nylon rope.
"Ready when you are," Natasha replied.
"Just be more careful than me in there," Aaron said.
"Don't worry," he said. "I will." He gave Aaron such a long kiss that Natasha had to turn away in embarrassment.
"I love you," Aaron whispered in his ear.
"I love you too."
"All right, you two," Natasha groaned. "Move it along."
Aaron apologized, and Bennett wondered if Natasha could see him blush in the dark. He didn't wait to find out. A moment later, he was rappelling into the cave. As best they could tell, the descent was roughly 65 or 70 feet down into the mountain. Where it went from there, he had no idea. Bennett took his time, lowering himself a few yards, checking his equipment, letting Aaron and Natasha adjust to his weight, then dropping another few yards. At the bottom, he finally remembered to turn on his radio. "Testing. 1, 2, 3, can you guys hear me?"
"Loud and clear,"
said Aaron.
"What do you see?"
"Not much, but man, it stinks down here. What in the world is..." Suddenly there was a high-pitched screeching sound and a rush of wind. Before he knew it, hundreds of bats were swarming all around him. He dropped to the ground and covered his head and face, but he could feel them everywhere, on his back and legs and hands and flapping around his ears. From the deepest recesses of the cave, they just kept coming. After what seemed like an eternity, the horrifying cacophony tapered off, and all was quiet again. Only then did he realize that what he was lying in wasn't mud, but a huge pool of bat guano. He radioed to the top that he was fine, but he could feel his heart pounding and the humidity rising, and he was beginning to perspire in all his gear. No one tells a billionaire he snores.
So Abdullah Farouk had no idea. None of his wives or concubines back in Riyadh had ever told him, nor had any of his lovers around the globe. And unbeknownst to him, both his bodyguards used earplugs at night so they wouldn't have to suffer his horrible racket. Tonight, they would suffer far worse. The guard by the back door was the first to die. He was shot in the chest with a silencer, then dragged out of the house and loaded into a stolen bakery truck. The guard by the front door got a steel pipe over the head and a knife across his throat. Before Farouk realized what was happening, four men were upon him. Two held him down, while a third stuffed a rag down his throat. The fourth jammed a needle into his wrist, injecting a lethal but traceless toxin. Farouk twisted and writhed in pain, but a minute later, both the snoring and the muffled screams had ceased. The four men stripped his body, carried him into the bathroom, and set him in the tub. Then they drew a nice hot bath, waited for the tub to fill, and slit Farouk's wrists, leaving the razor blade on the bloody tiled floor. 30 seconds later, a baker's truck rolled through the streets of Amman, attracting no attention at all. Chapter 58. Tuesday, January 20th, 2:31 a.m., Mount Ebal, the West Bank. Nearly 3 hours had passed. Bennett had found nothing yet. He wanted to make sure he would be able to find his way back through the labyrinthine series of tunnels and small corridors branching off the main passageway, so he dropped glow sticks every 20 yards or so. He pressed onward. At the beginning, the tunnel had been about 4 feet from one side to the other. Now, as he continued his descent, the walls narrowed steadily. At the same time, the tunnel began to shrink from 6 or 7 feet high near the entrance to a point where it was less than 3 feet high, forcing him to crawl on his hands and knees through more bat droppings and who knew what else. Bennett noticed that the stench didn't seem as bad, or perhaps he'd just gotten used to it. He also noticed that his radio was no longer working. He quickly changed batteries, but it didn't help. He had gone too deep to get any reception. But he couldn't stop now, so he dropped another glow stick and continued his journey into the subterranean maze. Back on the surface, Aaron was panicking.
"I'm sure he's fine," said Natasha. "He knows what he's doing."
"How do you know?" Aaron shot back more aggressively than she'd meant.
"You barely know him."
"I know more than you think," Natasha replied. "Uncle Eli used to go on and on about you guys until I thought I was going to be sick."
"Really?" said Aaron. "He never mentioned you at all."
She suddenly realized how cold that sounded.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude." "It's all right," Natasha said. "I know what it's like to worry about someone you love."
"Your grandfather?" Aaron asked.
"Actually," said Natasha, "I was thinking about my husband."
Aaron was startled, to say the least.
"Your husband?"
"Binyamin," Natasha said softly. "He was in the Navy, a SEAL, you'd call him. Anyway, he went out on a mission off the coast of Beirut, and he never came back."
"I'm so sorry," said Aaron. "I had no idea."
"It was a long time ago," said Natasha. "Almost 10 years.
Still, to Aaron, the pain in her new friend's eyes looked fresh.
"First your parents, and then your husband?"
"All the luck, huh?"
said Natasha, her bottom lip beginning to quiver. Just a little farther, Bennett decided. It was foolish, he knew. He was now at least 3 miles into the mountain. He must be nearing its core, he thought, but he couldn't go back without knowing for sure. He took a gulp of water and squeezed around a tight corner and through a narrow crevice, dripping with water. A minute went by, then 2, then 5. Then, all of a sudden, the tunnel opened up into a large cavern. He could finally stand again, and when he did, he found himself at a dead end. And then he noticed something odd. Scattered about the floor of the cavern were 6 large piles of rocks. Where had they come from? They were obviously not natural formations, but who had put them there? And why? Bennett's heart rate began to rise. He set down his backpack, pulled out a digital camera, and snapped a few pictures. Then he stuffed the camera back in its bag and got started. It was excruciating, back-breaking work. But after 15 minutes, Bennett had cleared most of the rocks off the first pile. He pulled a spade from his pack and was preparing to dig
when he realized he had already hit solid granite. There was nothing buried under the stones, absolutely nothing. Bennett repeated the process with the second pile and the third, but each time he found nothing, and what little hope he had left quickly began to fade. It was now 3:30 in the morning. By the time he got back to the cave entrance, it would be at least 5, and then he'd have to climb his way out. There would be no time left to explore another cave. At that point, they'd barely have enough time to get home before sunrise, but the thought of turning back with nothing to show for it made him physically ill, and he pled with God to show him favor.
"Why are you here, Aaron?" Natasha asked.
The question came without warning, and Aaron wasn't sure what she meant.
"Why are you doing this, you and John?" Natasha pressed. "Why risk your life for something that means nothing to you? I mean, this is my life, and it was my grandfather's, but you've got no stake in this thing. Sure, it was important to Uncle Eli, and maybe you'll track down his killers, but maybe not. Maybe they'll get you first."
Aaron looked in Natasha's eyes. She was serious, and she was waiting for an answer Aaron didn't feel comfortable giving. But it was the truth, and she was too tired to come up with anything different.
"Have you ever heard the expression, 'The safest place to be is in the center of God's will'?"
"No," said Natasha.
"It just means if God wants you to do something, you'd better do it, even if it sounds a little crazy. Jesus said, 'If you love me, you will keep my commandments.' And I love him more than I can possibly explain, so I try to be faithful to whatever he asks of me. And if he told you to jump off a bridge?" "No, no, it's not like that," said Aaron. "But it is a little hard to explain if you've never..."
She paused abruptly, then shifted gears.
"How many languages do you speak, Natasha? Speak or read?"
"Whatever."
"7, said Natasha.
"Wow, that's amazing.
How about you?"
Natasha demurred.
3, said Aaron. "English, Arabic, and Russian. A little Farsi, I guess, but not much. But my point is that regardless of how many languages I could speak, if you were talking to me in Hebrew right now, I'd have absolutely no idea what you were saying. You could be telling me exactly where the treasure is, and I wouldn't know it. You could be telling me how you met your husband and fell in love, but I'd have no idea. Why? Because I don't know Hebrew. I haven't studied it, much less become fluent. It would mean nothing to me, and I'd miss everything you were trying to say to me. And you know, the same is true with God. He says he loves us with an everlasting love. He has plans to give us a hope and a future. He says he wants to adopt us into his family and have a personal relationship with us, to walk with us and talk with us, and tell us great and mighty things we do not know. But unless we become true followers of his and learn to speak his language, we'll completely miss what he's trying to say. How did King Solomon put it? He is intimate with the upright. And Jesus said, 'My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give eternal life to them.' For most of my life, I didn't get that. I wasn't an atheist, mind you. Intellectually, I believed God existed, of course, but I just didn't care. He seemed irrelevant to me, distant, removed, far away, and unconcerned with my life and my problems. And I think that was partly because I had no idea what I was missing."
"And do you think God wants you to be out here?" asked Natasha, "in the heart of the West Bank, in the deep of the night, in bitter cold and whipping winds, hoping your husband finds some ancient Jewish treasure or at least comes out alive?"
"I wouldn't be here if I didn't," said Aaron. "And besides, what if God has more than one reason for me to be out here?"
"Like what?"
asked Natasha.
"Like giving you the chance to know the Messiah and hear his voice as well."
Chapter 59. Tuesday, January 20th, 5:17 a.m., Mount Ebal, the West Bank. It wouldn't be long until daylight. Aaron and Natasha were growing increasingly worried about John Bennett. He wasn't back. He hadn't checked in for hours. There was no way for them to contact him unless they went in after him. But if he didn't get back soon, with or without good news, they would have to drive back in daylight, and that meant the chances of getting caught or killed would rise dramatically.
"I'm going in," Aaron said at last. She began fishing through one of the backpacks to get the gear she'd need.
"Oh, no, you're not,"
insisted Natasha. Not in your condition.
I can't leave him in there by himself, Erin replied. What if something terrible has happened to him?
You're not well enough, Erin, not yet, and you've been up all night.
I'll be fine, Erin insisted, but Natasha obviously wasn't convinced.
Maybe we need to think about turning ourselves in. Didn't your friend, that Costello guy, say he could talk to the Prime Minister for you? I'm sure they'd send out a team to help us.
We're not turning ourselves into Derone.
Why not?
Because I don't know who I can trust in that office, and neither do you, said Erin. You know as well as I do that the only chance we have of finding the people who killed Mordecai and your grandfather is finding the treasure, and we can't do that if we're in prison or dead.
But Natasha wouldn't let it go. What about your friend at CIA, Rajiv somebody?
Indira Rajiv?
Right, said Natalie. Didn't John want you to enlist her help?
I called her several times. I never heard back.
So call her again.
For what?
I don't know, said Natasha. For satellite coverage? An extraction team? Advice? Something. Anything. She helped you before. I'm sure she'd help you again, especially if she knew you and John were in danger.
Erin considered that for a moment. Maybe Natasha was right. They were flying solo, and it wasn't going well. If there was anyone she could trust, she figured it was Rajiv. And even if she couldn't help them directly, perhaps Rajiv could point them to someone who could help. Erin powered up the satellite phone and called Rajiv's cell phone. There was no answer. She tried the home number, but again got voicemail. She closed her eyes and tried to think. Rajiv had a satellite phone as well, but what was the number? Finally, it came to her, and she dialed.
Hi, this is Indira. I'm sorry I can't take your call right now, but please leave a message and I'll get right back to you.
Her anxiety about John rising quickly, Erin decided to leave a message. It was a risk, to be sure, but for the moment, she couldn't think of what else to do.
Indira, it's me, Erin. I really need your help. We're in the West Bank, near Nablus. John's missing. He went into a cave on Mount Ebal and never came back. Call me as soon as you can, please. It's urgent.
Then she gave Rajiv their sat phone number and hung up.
No luck? Asked Natasha.
No, said Erin.
She donned her gear and prepared to head into the cave. Natasha stepped in front of her, blocking the way.
I can't let you go in there. You'll just hurt yourself. Isn't there anyone else you can call?
No, said Erin. I'm sorry, there just isn't. Now I'm going in. I'll call you as soon as I find him, and we'll figure out what to do then.
She started forward again. Natasha didn't move.
You think something's really happened to him? Why else would he be taking so long?
Maybe he found something.
Then he'd call in.
Maybe he's out of range.
Look, if something has happened to him, and believe me, I hope to God that nothing has, but if it has, you're not going to be able to get him out of there alone. Even together we couldn't do it. We need more bodies, and we're going to need a helicopter.
Erin thought about that.
What about yours? She asked. Not possible. Why not?
Well, first of all, it's not mine, said Natasha.
Second, there's no way to get it out of Jerusalem with all the police and border patrol out looking for us.
How about you? Know anyone else with a helicopter?
Someone who won't turn us in?
Narrows it down, doesn't it? Asked Natasha.
A bit, yeah, said Erin.
She thought a moment.
Actually, she said, there is somebody.
Who?
Dmitry Galishnikov.
Natasha raised her eyebrows.
Miriam's boss? She asked.
Erin nodded.
The founder and CEO of Medexco? The richest man in Israel?
That's him, said Erin, and he's got a fleet of choppers. Better yet, he's got a license to fly all of them. When he was younger, much younger, before he struck oil, he used to run commando missions for the IDF.
Really? Asked Natasha. I had no idea.
Erin pulled out the phone again and dialed.
It's ringing,
she said a moment later.
Hello, Mr. Galishnikov. It's Erin Bennett. I am so, so sorry to wake you, but I'm afraid John and I very much need your help.
Under the fourth rock pile, Bennett hit pay dirt. Buried in the center of the stones was a large clay pot, not unlike the ones he had seen in the shrine of the book. His hands began to tremble with excitement. He carefully tipped the pot and shined his headlamp inside, and there, waiting undisturbed for the past 2,000 years, was yet another scroll. Natasha was not about to let Aaron go into the tunnel alone. But they were both becoming more and more concerned. Natasha was almost to the point of going in herself to look for Bennett when there came a shout from the bottom of the cave shaft. A few minutes later, John's filthy face appeared.
"Thank God you're okay," Aaron exclaimed, giving her husband a huge embrace. "You had me freaking out up here."
"I'm sorry. I'm okay, really. I'm fine," he promised, giving her a long and tender kiss.
"What happened?" she asked, coming up for air. "What took you so long?"
"It's a long story," said Bennett. He pulled off his backpack and unzipped it. Then he pulled out a blanket and slowly, carefully unwrapped it. And there, in its center, was the scroll. "No treasure in there," Bennett said as he handed Natasha their latest clue, "but it wasn't a complete waste of time. At least I come bearing gifts." There was no time to examine the scroll. All three lifted their heads as a distant rumble, almost like thunder, grew nearer and intensified.
"What is that?" Bennett asked.
"Probably our ride," said Aaron, glancing at her watch. "Right on time."
"What are you talking about?"
"Natasha and I were getting worried about you," she said, "so I decided to call in some backup."
"Aaron, you didn't," Bennett said, still looking around for the source of the growing noise. "Tell me you didn't call Darone."
"I didn't call Darone."
"Aaron."
"I didn't call Darone, John," she insisted. "Ye of little faith."
Aaron and Natasha both stood and together helped the exhausted Bennett to his feet as a Bell 430 executive helicopter began descending a few yards away. Bennett peered into the cockpit just as the morning sun began to peek over the eastern mountains, only to find a familiar face at the controls.
"You called Dimitri?" he yelled over the roar of the rotors.
"I couldn't think of anyone else," Aaron shouted back.
"You're amazing."
"Thanks. Now let's go before someone figures out what we're doing up here."
Mariano's team stared in shock. They watched in stunned silence as the jet helicopter touched down halfway up the western face of Mount Ebal. They thought they had prepared for every eventuality, but they hadn't prepared for this.
"What do we do?"
one of the men radioed to his team leader.
"Take them out. I repeat, take them out."
The back door of the chopper swung open. There were three large men in the back, security types, Aaron figured, probably working for Medexco, and they eagerly helped Bennett and the women scramble aboard with all of their gear, then quickly closed the door behind them.
"Welcome to Air Jerusalem,"
Galishnikov said over the intercom as the chopper began to gain altitude.
"It is an honor to have you aboard this morning. Please buckle your seatbelts and make yourselves comfortable. We'll be flying today at..."
A gunshot suddenly shattered the side window. Two more shots ripped into the fuselage. Natasha was screaming. Blood covered her face. Another shot shattered the co-pilot's window, though fortunately there was no one in that seat. Bennett instinctively pushed Aaron and Natasha to the floor and covered their bodies with his own. One of the men near Bennett smashed out one of the back windows with the butt of a rifle and began returning fire. A moment later, another did as well. Galishnikov swung the bird around and they began to climb rapidly. They could still hear rounds smashing into metal all around them, but before they knew it, they had cleared the mountain and were racing westward, trembling, wounded, and wondering who had found them and how. Chapter 60. Tuesday, January 20th, 8:12 a.m., Mediterranean coast of Israel. Eventually, they landed at Galishnikov's seaside estate in Netanya. Perhaps someday, thought Bennett, they'd be able to relax on the grounds of the palatial 5-acre, $19 million compound, with its tennis courts, swimming pool, and fountains, all overlooking the glistening Mediterranean. But this, he knew, wasn't going to be that day. Dimitri's wife, Katya, met them on the landing pad and hurried them inside and into the spacious living room as Dimitri explained what had just happened. Then Katya wrapped Erin in blankets, got her tucked in on a couch, and began treating Natasha's facial lacerations while Dimitri made coffee and brought in some rolls and fruit.
"How about you?"
Katya asked Bennett when she had finished with the others. Are you okay? Just a little rattled, he said, grateful for the hot mug in his cold hands, and worried about those two.
I'd imagine so, she replied. I just feel sick about what's happening to the three of you. Eli, then Yossi, and now this. It's madness. I don't know how you three are still functioning.
Adrenaline, said Bennett.
Caffeine, said Aaron, peeking out from the blankets. Revenge, said Natasha.
A chill settled over the room, despite the fire now crackling in the fireplace.
Yes, well, how can we help? Asked Dmitri. What do you need now?
Bennett looked at Aaron, then at Natasha. A lawyer, for starters, he said.
I guess so, said Dmitri. Well, I'm afraid Katya here doesn't practice much anymore, but I could make some calls.
No, no, said Bennett. You'd be perfect, Mrs. Galishnikov. Do you still have your license?
Please, Jonathan, she replied. We've known each other too long. Call me Katya. But yes, I still have a valid law license.
And everything we say from this point forward would be covered by attorney-client privilege?
Of course, she said. And from what I can tell, you've got an airtight case for self-defense.
Actually, that's not our main concern right now, said Bennett.
What is? Asked Dmitri.
Again, Bennett looked at Aaron and Natasha. Both nodded, though each a bit reluctantly. So he opened his backpack, pulled out the blanket, and set it on the coffee table in front of them, where he unwrapped it until the scroll he had found deep inside Mount Ebal was visible. The Galishnikov stared in disbelief.
What is it? Asked Dmitri.
Bait, Bennett replied.
Mariano slammed down the phone and unleashed. He threw a plate across the kitchen. When it smashed against the refrigerator, he began heaving everything on the table across the room, plates, glasses, silverware. Then he flipped the table over and stormed around Miriam Gozal's house, cursing at the top of his lungs. Lost them? His team had actually lost the Bennetts and the Barak girl? It was unbelievable. It was impossible. Now what was he supposed to do? Someone would pay for this failure. Bennett laid out the whole story. The serial killings, Mordecai's last words, how they had met the Baraks and learned about Abdullah Farouk. Finding the key scroll. Their emerging theory that perhaps the copper scroll was an elaborate ruse designed to cause people to look in dozens of different locations when the treasures, if they were in fact real, could be hidden in just a single location. Bennett's new theory was that now that they had the key scroll and the scroll from Mount Ebal, they had the initiative. If they could only find the treasure, Mordecai's killers would find them, and the conspiracy that had left a trail of blood from London to Los Angeles would soon unravel.
And that gunfire back there? Asked Dmitri.
Bennett nodded. The bait is working.
And you think this scroll will lead you to the treasures?
It better, he said. It's the only hope we've got. An hour later, Mariano's team pulled into the driveway. They gathered in the living room of Miriam Gozal's house. Their heads hung low. The team leader explained what had happened as Mariano paced the thick Persian carpets, barely able to contain the rage seething within. He didn't ask questions. He didn't ask for clarifications. The team leader just continued talking, and Mariano finally could take it no longer. Before anyone realized what he was doing, he drew his silenced pistol and fired two bullets into the man's head. Everyone got the message. Mariano didn't want excuses. He wanted the Bennetts and whatever they had found in that cave. Natasha excused herself from the discussion. She was still in pain, still battling shock, but she knew full well that none of them were going anywhere until she cleaned and translated the scroll they'd just found. The longer she waited, the more danger they were in. So she requested a toothbrush, baking soda, a glass of water, and a washcloth, and headed for the dining room as Katya went to gather the items. But Dmitri still had more questions.
You're certain this Abdullah Farouk fellow is behind all this killing? He asked.
I'm not sure if it'd hold up in court, but yes, we're sure, said Bennett.
And you think that's who opened fire at you?
I doubt it was Farouk personally, but his people, sure.
How much do you know about him?
Not much, Bennett conceded. Obviously an heir to an enormous fortune, said to be worth several billion dollars, But Farouk is also believed to be a shrewd investor. For the past several years, he's been concentrating most of his assets in Iraqi oil and real estate. But his real passion is collecting antiquities. He apparently owns one of the world's largest private collections of Babylonian, Persian, and Roman artifacts, and keeps most of it at his summer estate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, overlooking the Red Sea. Fancies himself an amateur archaeologist, but has obtained most of his collection through auctions and on the black market.
"And you said he's obsessed with hunting the Ark?" asked Dmitri.
"That's putting it mildly," Bennett replied. "He once told a London paper that the Ark wasn't some relic to be put in a museum, but a weapon of mass destruction that would help Arab leaders build a caliphate from Morocco to Pakistan."
"Then I doubt he's working alone," said Dmitri.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean it doesn't sound like he wants the Ark sitting on his mantle if he finds it. He's an ideologue. He thinks the Ark can help someone build a new Arab empire. The question is, who is the someone he's working with?"
Bennett suddenly realized just how tired he and Aaron were. They hadn't been thinking through the larger geopolitical picture. They'd been in pure survival mode. "Farouk has had a great deal of contact with Iraqi officials of late, though I'm not sure exactly who," said Bennett, considering the implications.
"You don't think there's an al-Hassani connection to all this, do you?"
"After the firestorm, who else is standing?" said Dmitri.
Whoa, wait a minute," said Erin, pulling herself up to a sitting position. "Aren't we getting a little ahead of ourselves?"
"Maybe," Bennett conceded, "but Dmitri has a point. Farouk has money and influence and a vision of a new Arab empire. But he couldn't build it on his own, even with the Ark in hand. He'd need a partner, someone with land, oil, an army, and an air force."
"But, John, really, Mustafa al-Hassani?" Erin countered. "Do you hear what you're saying? Al-Hassani was a philosophy professor, for crying out loud. Saddam threw him into the gulag for being a reformer. If we hadn't invaded Iraq, he'd still be rotting in prison. You really think the morning after he won 63% of the vote, he woke up and thought, 'Forget Thomas Jefferson, I think I'll pattern myself after Joseph Stalin?'"
"I don't know," said Bennett, "but be honest, neither do you."
"Maybe not," said Aaron, "but I know a few things. I know al-Hassani invited Eli Mordecai, the former head of the Israeli Mossad, to visit him in Iraq. I know he gave Mordecai classified Iraqi documents that exposed a conspiracy to overthrow the Russian government, a conspiracy that proved to be real, mind you. I know that al-Hassani has quietly confided to you and me that he might be open to a peace treaty with Israel. And I just don't see this guy hiring Abdullah Farouk to play Indiana Jones for him, then ordering his thugs to gun down Mordecai in broad daylight. The whole notion is ridiculous, John. Al-Hassani isn't crazy. Farouk is. It's him we should be looking for, period."
"You don't think al-Hassani could be trying to capitalize on the firestorm to rebuild the Babylonian Empire?" asked John.
"Rebuild the region, yes. But an empire? I doubt it. Even if he is, I highly doubt he's sending out hit teams to get it done."
"What if he is?" asked Bennett.
"John, how stupid do you think al-Hassani is? You think he would really gamble everything he's got after all we've done for him and his people to turn Iraq back into a base camp for a whole new wave of global terrorism?"
"Actually, I think that is precisely what Eli believed," said Dmitri.
John and Aaron both looked at him.
"As you know, Eli was quite skeptical of your country's efforts to rebuild Iraq. Not a critic, mind you, but a skeptic, to be sure. Remember what he said at your reception? He said the war of Gog and Magog wasn't the end, it was only the beginning. He said evil was regathering, that something worse was coming. And that last posting on his weblog, how did he put it again?"
Bennett reluctantly finished Galishnikov's thought, for those very words had been ringing in his ears ever since he had first read them.
"I supported the war in Iraq," Mordecai had written. "I believed Saddam Hussein was a serious threat to the region and the world, and I believed in the cause of regime change. Removing Saddam was not as easy as we had hoped, nor as quick. But the question isn't whether we should have gone to war in Iraq. The real question is, what exactly are we building there? Are we making Iraq safe for democracy, or safe for the Antichrist?"
Chapter 61. Tuesday, January 20th, 11:34 a.m., Mediterranean coast of Israel. It was time to change the subject.
"It won't be long until they track us here," said Aaron.
"What do you mean?" asked Dimitri.
"The tail numbers," Aaron explained. "Once they trace those, they'll know it was your helicopter."
"That's not public information," said Dimitri.
"Maybe not, but like John said, we think they're working with someone inside the Prime Minister's office."
Dimitri shook his head. "I can't believe that. A traitor in David Doron's inner circle? It's impossible, I tell you."
"Yet people keep dying, don't they?" said Aaron.
"With all due respect, sir, the question isn't whether there's a mole. It's how easily Farouk and his men can contact him, and how quickly Farouk can figure out where we are. That gives us only a few hours at best."
"Maybe you're right," said Dimitri. "But I have 3 homes, 92 drill sites, and the refineries. What are the chances they'll look here first?"
"These guys are pros. They won't think for 1 minute we're all hanging out at some oil well. They're coming here, believe me, and I'd suggest we not be here when they arrive."
Al-Hassani exploded.
"What do you mean you lost them?"
Vigo Mariano swallowed hard. He knew what was coming. He was just glad he and the Iraqi leader were separated by several hundred miles.
"We're doing everything we can, Your Excellency,"
Mariano insisted.
"My team from Jordan just landed in Tel Aviv."
"How many?"
"There are 3 of them plus the 4 of us."
"How'd they get in?"
"Does it matter? I told you I'm taking care of it."
"Why doesn't that reassure me?" sniffed Al-Hassani.
"Fine," said Mariano. "They're journalists. They're posing as an Italian television crew. They just rented a car. They're meeting me in Jerusalem in an hour."
"Weapons?"
"We'll give them what we can."
"And then what?"
Mariano stalled. The truth was, he had no idea. Technically, what Bennett had found wasn't a scroll. Not in the classic sense of the word, anyway. It was copper, like the others, but it was not rolled up, as scrolls typically are. Thus, it had no need to be sliced into pieces with a laser or a special circular saw. It actually looked more like a copper tablet. It was rectangular in shape, about 1 foot long and 1.5 feet wide, and engraved with an ancient form of Hebrew lettering. Exhausted, and still in pain from her wounds, Natasha took longer on the translation than might otherwise have been usual, but she was determined to get it right. Finally, after more than 2 hours, she finished typing her notes into the laptop she had borrowed from the Galishnikovs and called the group into the dining room where she had been working without a break.
"What have you got?" asked Bennett. "Are we on the right track?"
"I think so," said Natasha. "This may be the most intriguing one of all. Let me take it section by section."
She pulled up a split-screen image with a digital photograph of the first paragraph in the scroll on the left side and the English translation on the right. Then she read the English aloud.
"All the commandments that I am commanding you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply, and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your forefathers. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you, and let you be hungry, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord." "I ran a search," said Natasha. "That's Deuteronomy, chapter 8, verses 1 to 3. Now, watch this. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you will eat food without scarcity, in which you will not lack anything. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you." "That's also Deuteronomy chapter 8, Natasha noted, "but only verses 7 and 8, part of 9, and all of 10.
Bennett quickly explained to the Galishnikovs the missing link theory they'd been using to crack the scroll codes, then asked Natasha what was missing this time.
"I think the second half of verse 9 is the clue," said Natasha. She pulled up a new screen with the full verse. "A land where you will eat food without scarcity, in which you will not lack anything, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper." "Out of whose hills you can dig copper," she repeated. "That's it. That, I think, links it conclusively to the others."
"Go on," said Aaron. "Show us the next section." Natasha flashed a new image on the screen and read the text aloud.
"It came about in the sixth year, on the fifth day of the sixth month, as I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah, sitting before me, that the hand of the Lord God fell on me there. Then I looked, and behold, a likeness as the appearance of a man, from his loins and downward there was the appearance of fire, and from his loins and upward the appearance of brightness, like the appearance of glowing metal. Then he brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, behold, Shallum, the son of Kolhoze, the official of the district of Mitzpah, repaired the fountain gate. He built it, covered it, and hung its doors with bolts and bars. After him, Nehemiah, son of Azbuk, official of the half-district of Beth-Zur, made repairs as far as a point opposite the tombs."
"I'm not sure I could follow any of that," said Bennett. They were all thoroughly confused. Natasha did her best to walk them through it.
"What's interesting is that it's all scripture," she began. "What's odd is that it's a real mishmash. The first part comes from the book of Ezekiel, then it shifts abruptly to Nehemiah. The key, remember, is in finding the passages of scripture that are missing from the scroll. In this case, I think the most interesting missing portion is Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 7 and 8.
She pulled up the translation of those verses on the laptop.
"Then he brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. He said to me, 'Son of man, now dig through the wall.' So I dug through the wall, and behold, an entrance."
"You think the scroll's author is telling us to dig through a wall?" asked Bennett.
"Yes, that's exactly what I think," Natasha replied.
"But what wall?"
"That's where the next missing passage seems to come in. Shallum, the son of Kolhoze, the official of the district of Mitzpah, repaired the fountain gate. He built it, covered it, and hung its doors with its bolts and its bars and the wall of the pool of Shiloh at the king's garden, as far as the steps that descend from the city of David."
"The words in capital letters were missing from the scroll?" asked Dmitri.
"Exactly," said Natasha. "What's the pool of Shiloh?" asked Aaron.
"Oh, that's easy," said Katya. "Shiloh is a Hebrew variant of Shiloah, or Siloam," said Katya. "That could be the pool of Siloam in Jerusalem."
Bennett was stunned. "The pool near Hezekiah's tunnel?" he asked. "Where Jesus told the blind man to go wash and he would be healed?"
"Yes, that's the one," Katya confirmed.
All eyes turned to Natasha.
"Mrs. Galishnikov is 100% correct," she said. "And what's intriguing to me is that, according to John Marco Allegro, the first member of the Copper Scroll team to actually publish the original text in Hebrew and English, lines 50 and 51 of the Copper Scroll actually point to the Pool of Siloam."
She did a quick Google search for Allegro's translation and read it to the group.
"In the settling tank of the bathhouse of running water, under the gutter, 17 talents. And in four inner corner buttresses, tithe vessels, and inside them, figured coins."
Then Natasha added, "Other translators have put it a little differently. One has it, 'In the basin of the latrines, beneath the water outlet, 17 talents, in its pool at its four corners, tithe vessels and marked coins.' Either way, a number of scholars, Allegro, my grandfather, and Uncle Eli included, believe the bathhouse or latrines and the pool nearby were direct references to the pool of Siloam and the area around Hezekiah's tunnel. Now, the scroll that John has found may actually confirm that theory."
Wait a minute, said Bennett at the edge of his seat. Are you saying the temple treasures might actually be buried as close as the city of David?
I can't say I know for sure, of course, said Natasha, but that does seem to be where this scroll is pointing.
That's just a 5-minute walk from the Temple Mount, Erin gasped.
Chapter 62. Tuesday, January 20th, 1:16 p.m., Mediterranean coast of Israel. A shock of anticipation moved through the team. Could they really be that close? Or was this another massive, time-consuming diversion? And even if it was true, what exactly were they supposed to do? March into Jerusalem with a few bags of explosives and blast their way to the temple treasures? Natasha tried to keep everyone's expectations in check. She cautioned that over the decades, numerous archaeologists had prospected around the pool to no avail. A few had even been arrested. There was also the very real possibility that the reference to the Pool of Siloam was, in fact, another decoy. After all, none of the locations directly mentioned in the Copper Scroll had yet borne out to be true. Why should this one? Could the treasures be hidden behind a wall inside Hezekiah's tunnel? Bennett wondered. Natasha chewed on that for a little while. It would certainly be consistent with the text and the location, she agreed. The Pool of Siloam was an open-air water garden. No roof, no covering, and directly visible from at least 3 sides. The tunnel, on the other hand, was a perfect hiding place. Long, dark, narrow, and waist-deep, with often freezing water running from the Gihon spring. It certainly would have been hidden from the prying eyes of Roman soldiers 2,000 years ago, not to mention the watchful eye of Israeli soldiers today. Natasha went back and examined several other missing verses, then zeroed in on verse 16 from the Ezekiel passage.
He then brought me into the inner court of the house of the Lord, and there, at the entrance to the temple, between the portico and the altar, were about 25 men. With their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, they were bowing down to the sun in the east. I think that's it, said Natasha at last.
What? Asked Bennett as Erin checked her watch.
I think that's the clue we're looking for, Natasha said excitedly.
Which one?
He then brought me into the inner court, Natasha explained. I think we're supposed to go into Hezekiah's tunnel, into the exact center.
You're sure? Erin pressed, noting that they had to move soon if they were going to move at all.
Wait, wait, there's something else, said Natasha. Between the portico and the altar. That's another clue. We need to go halfway into the tunnel and then move 25 paces from the exact center.
How would we know which way? Asked Bennett.
Well, said Natasha, earlier in the passage, it says the men were doing something evil. They had their backs toward the temple of the Lord and bowed east toward the sun. I say we do the opposite. We go 25 paces west and try to break through the tunnel wall on the side facing the temple, digging toward the Temple Mount.
Bennett's heart was pounding. Everyone's was. He didn't fully understand it, but he trusted Natasha's experience. It had, after all, gotten them this far. Now all they needed was a plan.
How can we help? Asked Dmitri.
Can we borrow your helicopter? Asked Natasha.
You're kidding, right?
No, said Natasha. I'm fully rated.
Not my point, Dmitri replied. I'm going with you.
Natasha looked to Bennett. Dmitri, you know we'd love to have you with us, he said as tactfully as he could, but I think you've discovered enough treasure for one lifetime. Dmitri didn't bat an eye.
And what exactly are you planning to do, John? Fly into Jerusalem, land near Hezekiah's tunnel, and just leave the helicopter there? You really think that's not going to attract attention?
He's right, John, said Erin.
Of course I'm right, said Dmitri. Besides, there's no manhunt underway for me. I'll be able to get clearance to land in Jerusalem. None of you can. I'll fly in, drop you off, and then hightail it out of there until you call me to come back for you. That's it. That's my final offer.
Bennett looked at Erin, and then at Natasha. It wasn't like they had a lot of leverage.
We'll take it, he said, but we could also use some men to guard the tunnel. As many as you need, said Dmitri.
And some weapons, said Erin.
No problem.
And we'll need some other equipment, too, Natasha reminded them.
What kind? Asked Dmitri.
Something to blast through those walls would be nice.
Done, said Dmitri. Now, if you're all out of excuses,
I suggest we get going.
When they were in the air, Bennett called Ken Costello.
Hello?
Ken, it's John. You got a minute?
John, are you all right?
We're fine.
I just got a call from the Palestinian Interior Minister,
Costello explained.
He said there's been some kind of shooting incident outside of Nablus.
No comment, said Bennett.
Where are you now?
I can't say. Not yet, but Costello cut him off.
John, seriously, I'm telling you this as a friend. If you want the president to go to bat for you, you guys have got to come in now.
I need a few more hours.
Right now.
Ken, I'm only asking for a few more hours.
And if you get caught or killed?
Look, Ken, I give you my word. We'll come in today, but I need your help.
Are you crazy? You're going to get us all thrown in prison.
We found it, Ken.
What?
We think we've found the treasures of the Copper Scroll.
You're kidding.
I'm not.
And the Ark?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I mean, we haven't found the treasures yet, but we're pretty sure we know where they are.
And that's where you're headed?
Exactly.
But you're not going to tell me where, are you?
Not yet, Bennett admitted. But look, if something goes wrong, I'll call you. I'll tell you officially that Aaron, Natasha, and I are ready to come in. And then I'll need you to send me as much backup as you possibly can, and reporters.
Reporters?
Lots of them, with cameras, satellite trucks, the whole nine yards.
Why?
Asked Costello. Let's call it an insurance policy, said Bennett. Just promise me you'll be there for me if I need it.
Just promise me you'll turn yourself in by the end of the day,
Costello replied. I promise, said Bennett.
Then so do I,
said Costello. Indira Rajiv tried to remember where she was. She tried to remember what day it was, but it was all a blur. She blinked hard and stared at the phone next to her. A label on the handset read, The Rome Cavalieri Hilton. She glanced at the alarm clock. Was it already Tuesday? Had she really slept so long it didn't seem possible? She suddenly realized the phone next to her wasn't the one that was ringing. She got up, stumbled across the penthouse suite, and grabbed her satellite phone, answering it on the 10th ring.
Hello? She mumbled. Rajiv?
Indira, it's Aaron. Got a minute?
Rajiv was instantly awake.
Aaron, is that you? I've been worried sick about you.
Then where have you been?
Aaron replied.
I've been calling you for days.
Rajiv froze. She couldn't tell her she'd been escaping a mole hunt, of course. Nor could she tell her best friend that she'd actually gotten her voicemail and immediately relayed their location on Mount Ebal to Vigo Mariano's team, though they'd been too stupid to kill them when they had the chance. Come to think of it, Rajiv wondered, what could she tell her? When nothing came to mind, she quickly changed the subject.
It's a long story. I'll tell you later. The point is, where are you right now?
Aaron paused.
First promise me you won't turn me in,
she insisted.
Are you kidding? Asked Rajiv. You know me better than that.
You could lose your job if you don't,
Aaron warned. If you only knew, thought Rajiv, wondering how much longer it would be before Langley told the media she was on the run, wanted on charges of espionage.
Actually, said Rajiv, they'll probably give me a promotion.
Seriously, Indira,
Aaron insisted.
You could go to jail.
No one's going to jail, said Rajiv.
Then promise me.
Aaron, really, you've got to...
Promise.
Fine, Rajiv lied. I promise. Now what do you need?
There was a long pause. Rajiv feared Aaron wouldn't believe her. But then she said,
I think we've found it, Indira.
What?
The temple treasures.
Really? Asked Rajiv. How? Where?
I'll explain later,
said Aaron.
Right now I don't have much time.
Why? Where are you headed? Rajiv pressed.
Hezekiah's tunnel,
said Aaron.
We're in Dmitri's helicopter.
Dmitri Galishnikov?
Yeah. We should touch down in about 5 minutes.
How can I help? Asked Rajiv.
I need satellite coverage over the tunnel.
Expecting trouble?
Hoping for it, actually,
said Aaron.
We'll have guys watching both ends of the tunnel, but we need to buy as much time as possible.
Who's helping you?
Dmitri's security team will be guarding the tunnel,
said Aaron.
So you'll do this for me?
For you, anything, Rajiv answered. Where should I route the feed?
Rajiv no longer had access to American spy satellites, but Aaron didn't know that. And this phone call was the break she needed. Now, She just had to get the Bennett's location to Mariano and his men. Chapter 63. Tuesday, January 20th, 2:30 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. They landed in the Kidron Valley, about a mile away. Any closer, and Bennett feared they would attract too much attention. But that meant they had quite a hike ahead of them, uphill no less, with much gear and not much time. As they touched down, two of Golishnikov's security men jumped out of the chopper, armed with MP5 machine guns and communications gear to keep everyone connected. Bennett, Aaron, and Natasha were right behind them. Each grabbed an Uzi, ammo, and a backpack stuffed with sledgehammers, picks, flashlights, batteries, and bottles of drinking water, and began racing up the hill through the Arab village of Silwan toward the old city. When they looked back, Dmitri and the chopper were gone. 10 minutes later, they had reached the Gihon Spring. For thousands of years, the spring had been the only source of fresh water for Jerusalemites, who would exit the city gates each morning, fill pails with water, and bring them back to their homes. Now Bennett prayed it would somehow quench their thirst for justice. The key, Natasha had convinced him, was Hezekiah's tunnel. In 701 BCE, the Israelite king Hezekiah, fearing an imminent siege by the Assyrians, ordered his advisors to find a way to channel the water directly into the walled city in such a way that the Assyrians could neither find Jerusalem's water supply and cut it off, nor use it to sustain their own troops. But in order to complete the vital task before Sennacherib and his forces arrived, Hezekiah divided his men into two teams. One began digging from deep underneath the city toward the spring. The other began at the spring and chiseled their way toward the city. The result was a marvel of ancient engineering, a 1,750-foot-long S-shaped tunnel snaking its way through the limestone mountains to the Pool of Siloam, which at the time was located inside the walls of Jerusalem. And according to the scriptures, it was finished just in time. Israel's enemies were driven back, and the city and its temple were saved. How history would play out this time, Bennett had no idea. He glanced at his watch. On Tuesdays, the tunnel was only open to tourists from 8 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. It was now 2:47. He held the Uzi tight to his chest and peeked around a stone wall, then across the courtyard. There was no one there. The ticket booth was closed. The door leading to the tunnel was padlocked. Bennett turned and nodded to the others, and they made their move. While Arik and Roni, Golishnikov's security men, scanned the grounds for signs of movement, Bennett cut the lock and waved the others through. Everyone entered except for Roni. He would stay and watch their backs.
"Miss Erin?" "Yes, Roni," she whispered back. "I still can't log on to the satellite feed you were telling me about."
"Neither can I," said Arik.
"Don't worry," said Erin. "I just talked to my friend. I'm sure it will come online any minute. Keep trying. And call us on the radios if anything comes up."
"Will do," said Roni. "Godspeed."
"Thanks."
With that, the rest of the group scrambled down the stairs to the tunnel entrance, turned on their flashlights, and began their journey, with Bennett in the lead and Erin right behind him. Mariano's sat phone rang again. He instantly recognized the number. It was Rajiv, and he was furious.
"I told you to stay put and not make any more calls."
"I don't take orders from you,"
Rajiv shot back.
"He'll meet you," Mariano countered. "I told you he would, but I don't know when, and quite frankly, I'm in the middle of something right now."
"That's not why I'm calling."
"Then why?"
"Just shut up and listen,"
Rajiv barked.
"Where are you?"
"Why does it matter?"
"It just does. Now, where are you?"
Mariano didn't have time to play games, but given all Rajiv had given them so far, and the fact that she had left the CIA and her husband and was holed up in his hotel room in Rome, she probably deserved to be listened to for a few more minutes.
"We'd just left Tiberias."
"Headed where?"
she asked. "Jerusalem."
"What's your ETA?"
30-40 minutes tops. Why?"
"What about the team in Jordan?"
"In Tel Aviv, waiting for orders. Why, what's all this about?"
"Erin Bennett."
"What about her?"
"She just called."
The water was knee-deep and freezing cold. It was January after all, but at least it kept the team moving. The bigger problem was the fact that though the tunnel rose to a height of some 16 feet at the other end, in this stretch it was barely 5 feet high, making it all but impossible to run. They were moving as quickly as they could, but for Bennett it wasn't nearly fast enough. "Why didn't these guys just dig in a straight line?" he asked, hunched over and trying not to smack his head as he followed the serpentine route through the mountain.
"Most archaeologists say it was just the imperfections of their engineering knowledge at the time," said Natasha, having to raise her voice to be heard over all their sloshing. "But I think the more compelling theory is a more recent one."
"What's that?"
"It seems that there was actually a series of small, natural limestone caves riddled through the mountain like Swiss cheese. Hezekiah's people were basically digging from cave to cave to connect them all into one long pipeline."
"You're saying they were playing connect the dots down here?" asked Bennett.
"Yes," said Natasha, "you could say that."
The team kept advancing toward their objective. They were almost to the halfway point of the tunnel. Even as he tried not to think about the possibility of losing all his toes to frostbite, it struck Bennett that they were moving through 2,700 years of history. Every chisel mark his flashlight pointed to had been carved out by men who had lived a full 7 centuries before Jesus. Somewhere along the way, perhaps during the Middle Ages, though no one seemed to know for sure, the tunnel had fallen into disuse and disrepair. According to Natasha, it had been all but forgotten until an American by the name of Edward Robinson stumbled upon it in 1838. Then, in 1880, a young boy living in Jerusalem literally stumbled upon a remarkable discovery. While playing around the Pool of Siloam at the mouth of the tunnel, he slipped on some rocks and bumped his head. When he opened his eyes, he looked up and realized he was looking up at a Hebrew inscription carved into one of the tunnel's walls. After he told his parents and teachers, a group of archaeologists arrived to check out the boy's story. It turned out he had, quite by accident, found a description of how the tunnel was made, inscribed there by the workers who had made it. Most intriguing to Bennett, however, was Natasha's description of the work of a British officer named Montague Parker. In 1909, Parker brought a team to Palestine and began a 2-year process of cleaning out the tunnel and excavating its vicinity. The interesting thing was why. It turns out Parker had been hired by a Finnish philosopher and poet named Walter H. Juvelius, who had become absolutely convinced from studying the writings of the Jewish prophets, particularly the book of Ezekiel, that the temple treasures and the Ark of the Covenant would be found in or around Hezekiah's tunnel. Unfortunately, Natasha explained, Parker and his team hadn't paid off enough of the locals. Muslim leaders caught wind of what they were trying to do and ran them out of town, almost killing them in the process. Now Bennett wondered, would they fare any better? Chapter 64. Tuesday, January 20th, 3:10 p.m., Hezekiah's Tunnel, Jerusalem.
"Hold here for a moment," said Natasha.
"Why? What's the problem?" asked Bennett.
"Nothing," she insisted. "Just look up."
Bennett, Aaron, and Arik all pointed their flashlights toward the ceiling, now between 8 and 10 feet above the floor.
"I don't see anything," said Aaron. "It's hard to see without stronger lights," Natasha explained, "but the ceiling above us isn't natural limestone. It's part of an artificial wall. If you were to break through it, you'd find a vertical shaft about 1.5 meters wide, running some 12 meters straight up. That's connected to a larger vaulted cistern, which is connected to another series of tunnels and shafts. All told, the system extends some 70 meters to a secret well opening at the top, inside the old city of Jerusalem. It's called Warren's Shaft. Archaeologists believe that's how Jerusalemites got water up to the city before this tunnel was built."
"Never heard of it," said Aaron.
"Charles Warren, British military officer, 1867, said Natasha. "Look him up online when you get home."
"If we get home," said Bennett, his tactical pessimism rising to the fore.
"Why was it walled off?" asked Aaron.
"It's not clear exactly," said Natasha. "Some say the system dates back to the 10th century BCE, some 3 centuries before this tunnel was built. Eventually, of course, the tunnel moved the water more efficiently than the shaft system. So it's believed the Israelites sealed it up to keep all the water moving from the spring to the Pool of Siloam."
"Guys, we really need to keep moving," said Bennett.
Actually, we're already here, said Natasha. Arik, you can keep going, but we're just a few yards away.
Arik passed by and kept hustling toward the other end of the tunnel. Natasha, meanwhile, rechecked her map until she was sure they had found the precise center of the tunnel, then turned west and marched another 25 yards, based on her interpretation of the Mount Ebal scroll. Then she turned her flashlight against the right side wall, drawing John and Aaron's flashlights as well.
That's not limestone, said Bennett, pointing to a small square patch maybe 3 feet by 3 feet.
No, it's plaster, said Natasha, and it's old, very old. When the tunnel was first built, they sealed it up with plaster, so none of the water could leak out of the natural cracks and holes in the limestone. Every few centuries, they would re-plaster it, just to be sure, but obviously it's been a long time since it was done last.
Bennett tapped it with the butt of his Uzi. Some pieces began to flake off.
Was this